And let's jump right into our week in review, because there's a lot to talk about, including two big federal trials in Boston, parole for juveniles convicted of murder, and tougher gun control laws in Massachusetts. And with us now is former federal judge turned Harvard Law professor Nancy Gertner. Hello, Nancy. Good to have you.
Nice to be here.
And joining us from the Boston Globe is Dante Ramos. He's the deputy editorial page editor at the Globe. Hello, Dante. Happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you, too.
And before we get into the other top stories of the week, I'd love to talk to you quickly for a quick response to what we just heard from David LaFon. Dante, I'll start with you. Are we doing enough to make sure that old buildings like the one in Lowell are as safe as they can be? What do you think?
On some level, you know, the obvious response in these situations is to say that, of course, we're not doing enough, and there can always be situations where there's, you know, more inspections and better sprinkler requirements and so forth. It's important to understand why legislators have been a little shy about doing it, which is that, you know, as I think both you, Anthony, and David LaFon said, we have an older housing stock in Massachusetts. And the costs of retrofitting buildings are, you know, can be pretty significant, and especially in situations where, you know, the costs of that are getting passed on to people. So housing, you know, becomes a huge expense for people in Massachusetts, and there's a number of safety requirements that I think we would all love to see applied to housing. But, you know, there is a sort of reluctance for just, you know, to avoid overinflating the cost of something that's already super expensive in Massachusetts. That sounds kind of crass to say, but it's got to be a calculation that the legislature is going to make.
No, sure. It's a calculation in the real world, no doubt. Nancy, your thoughts on this?
It seems to me that whatever the expense you impose it on people, it's we have cab drivers who have to have levels of insurance when they're dealing with the public. It seems to me, particularly since the stock of housing in Massachusetts is so overwhelmingly older. I mean, this was a 100-year-old building. It seems to me that it's reasonable to talk about to require sprinklers and figure out some way to defray the cost. But this just shouldn't be happening.
Well, let's move on and talk about the other big news of the week, beginning with the trial of former probation chief John O'Brien, who's accused of concealing a sham hiring scheme in the Department of Probation. The prosecution rested its case earlier today. The defense said that it will call no witnesses. The defense closed its case with the same contention that it's made all along, that John O'Brien did nothing wrong. So, Nancy, jurors will get the case presumably next week. What do you make of this defense strategy? No witnesses.
Well, given what had already come out in the cross-examination of the government's witnesses, it seems to me it's a reasonable strategy. It's also the case that the jury may not get the case next week. The judge has to make a decision whether there's even remotely enough evidence to get to a jury. The defense was that giving jobs in exchange for goodwill at the state house is not bribery. Nobody pocketed any money. There was no proof that anyone pocketed any money at all. It's not what we understand to be bribery. And the testimony that they were able to bring out about the hiring of court officers by the judges was pretty stunning. It seems to me that this is yucky and wrong and maybe should be legislated about, but it is not a crime. So they brought out their case through the government's witnesses, and therefore there was no need for them to put on witnesses.
Dante, I want to come to you with a question about fallout. This week, House Speaker Robert DeLeo responded to some pretty serious allegations from prosecutors that he was complicit in a scheme to trade jobs at the probation department for legislative favors. And that allegation, DeLeo vigorously denied Wednesday. Here he is.
Let me just be very, very clear. Any statements or any innuendos that there were any quid pro quo in terms of jobs or money or whatever is false and untrue. And anyone who says that knows it's untrue.
Dante, where does this leave Robert DeLeo? I mean, does he go deeper into this scandal, into this muck? Does he survive it? What's your view?
One of the things that I found striking about his statement was he didn't say that he wasn't pushing people for certain jobs. He, you know, didn't say that other lawmakers weren't doing that either. You know, he said that, oh, I wasn't pushing anybody that that I thought was unqualified. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a remarkable admission in a way. I mean, the discussion has been about political patronage and that this case is emblematic of it. You know, there doesn't at this point seem to be much penalty to be paid, particularly in a system. It's really more of a one-party government where, you know, normally if in a state where there are two strong political parties, you would have one or the other making a big deal if a speaker of the other party, you know, had said such a thing as DeLeo did about essentially admitting that he was pushing candidates for non-political jobs. There's in other states, there's really a political penalty to be paid for that. And so far, there hasn't been here. I think a lot will kind of depend on what the outcome of the O'Brien trial is. I mean, my own sense is that, you know, he's not on trial. O'Brien is not on trial just for general yuckiness or sleaziness. You know, the specific allegation was that there is a specific system that was set up to avoid the kind of patronage hiring that O'Brien and his probation department specifically engaged in, and that hiring system was specifically thwarted in a fraudulent way. Now, I don't know whether the jury is going to convict O'Brien of that or not. I think if he is acquitted, it certainly becomes easier for people to shrug their shoulders and say, you know, this is kind of a prosecutorial overreach, and there wasn't really much substance to this, and they kind of went after O'Brien with vague evidence. If, on the other hand, he's convicted, it does send a little bit more of a message both to DeLeo and future speakers, and I think it does intensify the question of, well, you know, is there further legal fallout that happens? I think a lot depends upon the outcome of the trial.
Well, Nancy, I'd love to ask you about sort of the DeLeo fallout, the DeLeo angle. 50 state reps and senators have been called before a federal grand jury. None have been charged. Prosecutors are talking about fraud and bribery. But DeLeo was never called to testify before the grand jury on this trial. I just put that out there. Where does this leave DeLeo, do you think?
Well, let me first mention the fact that he hasn't been charged and that none of the representatives have been charged. I mean, typically in a bribery situation, the person who does the bribing and the person who accepts the bribe are both charged. So the fact that the representatives and DeLeo were not charged says something significant. And I have to part company with Dante here. Patronage takes place in court systems, in clerk's offices, in you know, the ambassadorships of our country. It may be it ought to be controlled. It may be that it ought to be addressed. But you can't, after the fact, turn it into a crime. So the question then is, what did O'Brien do that suddenly made this different than what goes on every day and for which maybe there's a political penalty? Not sending the man away to jail. Was it because it was more systematic? That doesn't make it a crime. Nobody took money. What you got in exchange was essentially more favorable treatment of the department. Really, if this is a crime, then we need to undo, you know, go through the American government, the local government, the city government, and everything.
Well, go ahead, Dante.
I'd just like to respond to that. I mean, I think the question is, you know, it's not just that O'Brien engaged in an activity that was, you know, that lots of other people do. I mean, again, there's a specific system that was set up precisely to avoid this kind of thing that was then thwarted. You know, far be it from me to disagree on a matter of law with a former federal judge, but it does strike me that there is a, you know, qualitative difference between, you know, between engaging in patronage and falsifying a system that was specifically set up to defeat patronage. Mm.
Then it is arguably a state crime, not a federal crime, for which the penalties could be an unbelievable amount of time in jail. Let me say one other thing, and this is an issue with Dante. Just because something is a Globe Spotlight team story doesn't make it a crime.
All right, let's move on. So we're going to move on to another courtroom at the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston and to another big trial underway this week, and that's of Azamat Tazayakov, the friend of accused marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Federal authorities allege that he obstructed the investigation by destroying evidence and lying to investigators. Here's Tazayakov's father, Amir, speaking through an interpreter on Monday and declaring his son innocent.
Не доводили бы дело до суда. Естественно, он не виноват.
So he's absolutely innocent, and we're in a trial specifically because he feels innocent.
Если бы мы не верили 100% правосудию Америки, мы не пошли бы в этот суд. Нам давно договорились бы прокуратуре.
If we wouldn't
Поэтому
believe,
мы верим Америке.
If we wouldn't believe to United States, and we wouldn't believe to legal system in the United States, we would never go to the trial. We would took a plea.
So, Nancy, I know you've been following this case. What do you think of the case against this young man, the father there making the case that he thinks he can beat the charges, which is why they didn't take the plea?
The issue is going to turn not around what he did, since I think the allegations are clear about what he and the two others did, which was throwing the backpack away and retaining a computer without actually ever deleting files or changing right. Tsarnaev's computer.
And the backpack you're referring to, of course, was a backpack that belonged to Jahar Tsarnaev.
That's right. So the question is, you know, it's the classic issue of what did he know? Not only what did he know and when did he know it, but what did he intend to do by this? It's very interesting. The government has two obstruction, actually more than two obstruction of justice charges, statutes. And what they've done is they've proceeded under the one that has the lowest burden of proof. This was a statute that was passed as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation to keep corporations from destroying records. So they have chosen what would be the lower burden of proof. And the question is going to be essentially what these young men intended to do by what they did. Mm. And it completely revolve around what their state of mind is.
Mm. Dante, what do you think? What they knew, when they knew it? What's your reading on this case so far?
I basically agree with Nancy. It seems like they were, you know, they're charged in a fairly aggressive way. And, you know, not to make excuses for anything that might have happened in this case or the destruction of evidence, you do see a situation where there are these two people who are nationals of, you know, another country where the authorities are probably not held in very strong repute. They get the news that their stoner friend might be a homicidal terrorist, or it begins to dawn on them that might be possible, and they react in a way that involves the destruction of evidence. You know, it's a different situation from, as Nancy said, it's not, you know, this isn't really a Sarbanes-Oxley type violation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a corporation behaving in a sophisticated way to evade, you know, existing disclosure requirements or discovery requirements or anything like that. It's a different scenario, and you end up with these young men being charged in a fairly aggressive way. The other thing I would say, and I think Nancy would probably agree with me on this, is that it seems just from what we're hearing in the testimony that a lot depends upon the recollections of the FBI agents and their notes of their conversations with Jahar Tsarnaev's friends. And, you know, it's always a controversial point about how much of interviews or interrogations ought to be recorded so that you don't end up with questions of the agent saying, oh, well, this was in my notes, and therefore, you know, people are being charged against something that is essentially he said, she said.
Mm. Well, let's move on to another law and order issue from this past week. The state Senate approved a bill that would allow juveniles convicted of first-degree murder to become eligible for parole after serving between 20 and 30 years in prison. So this bill is an effort to reconcile state law with Supreme Court decisions that found mandatory juvenile life sentences without parole to be unconstitutional, in large part because of what we understand now about brain science and the fact that the brains of young offenders are not fully developed. So here's Senator Will Brownsberger. He's co-chair of the Joint Committee on the Judiciary. He backs the bill, but he says that lawmakers had trouble knowing where to draw the line.
I really don't know what it takes to rehabilitate those kids who have committed those really horrendous offenses, and I don't think the brain science sheds any light whatsoever on their level of culpability, really, or their ability to be rehabilitated. I don't think we know enough about that yet.
So Senator Brownsberger there, Nancy, not wanting to venture too deeply into the thicket of brain science, but do you think this bill strikes the right balance in terms of fairness to juvenile offenders?
No. The brain science does say something about the potential for rehabilitation of juveniles. It doesn't say precisely the time, but that only suggests that to some degree you give judges and you give parole authorities discretion to figure out when that time is. There are studies, notwithstanding what Senator Brownsberger said, across the country showing what kinds of programmatic changes, what kinds of programs mostly can be put in place that would make a difference to juveniles. Here we have set a one-size-fit-all rule, and what we know about juveniles is that they're not little adults, that the crimes are oftentimes crimes of impulsivity, and that their brains are changing. So it's exactly, in one sense, it's the opposite of what Senator Brownsberger said. If this is a fluid situation, all the more reason to try to individualize the response. Hmm.
Dante, your response to the Senate bill?
Roughly similar. It's important to remember that this was a response to high court rulings about, needing to reform the juvenile penalties to comply with sort of evolving views. And this is a pretty grudging response in the sense that the governor had proposed a much lower minimum penalty or a minimum threshold at a point when parole could be considered. And that's the other thing is, Nancy's talking about the need to have a sort of individual determination. Parole, in a way, can be that individual determination. These aren't situations where someone is automatically paroled at a certain time. It just becomes the point where a juvenile offender can be considered for parole. And it's notable that one of the provisions in the law, after you get rejected for parole, if you're a juvenile offender, there's a period, I believe in the most recent iteration of the bill, about 10 years.
No, it's 5
after,
years.
5 years, I'm five sorry. Years. There's a long period of time after which you can't seek another hearing. And it certainly doesn't provide much of an ability for a person who's rejected by the parole board, which in Massachusetts has been pretty stingy about paroling people, to prove that they've rehabilitated themselves.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to another law enforcement issue. It seems to be all sort of justice law enforcement this week. The House approved a bill that would tighten the state's gun laws after a few last-minute tweaks. The bill was the result, of course, of the school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, in which 20 children were shot and killed. The main provisions include requiring schools to develop plans to address students' mental health needs. It would give police more discretion to deny gun permits under certain circumstances, and the state would also join a national database for criminal and mental health background checks. The final gun control bill was praised by both advocates of tighter gun control and people like Jim Wallace, head of the Massachusetts Gun Owners Action League. Here he was yesterday talking to supporters.
On Wednesday, we actually got rid of House 4121 and are now dealing with a brand new bill that's far less onerous and a vastly improved piece of legislation, House 4278. As you know, Gun Owners Action League is the state association that fights very, very hard to protect our Second Amendment civil rights. And we've got your back on this.
All right, they've got your back. Dante, I'm struck by, here's a gun control bill that both sides appear to agree on.
Yeah, it's what's interesting about it is that goal, Jim Wallace's group, they made a determination early on, maybe looking at the politics of Massachusetts, that that some sort of further restrictions after Newtown, after everything else that we've seen, that there was a gun bill that was likely to pass, and that they wanted to be part of it rather than just standing in opposition to it. And it certainly, if I was talking before about the downside of one party rule in the state, if this, in a way is an upside, they saw that there's a strong Democratic majority in both houses, saw that there was a strong desire on the part of lawmakers to have stronger gun legislation in the state and try to be a part of it rather than obstructing it. What you really want to see is surrounding states and the federal government have legislations that begin, from my point of view, that begin to look like Massachusetts is. Unfortunately, the equivalents of Jim Wallace in those states and on the federal level are not going to be so participatory or cooperative.
And this is really a crucial point in this debate, because throughout it, it's been pointed out that in order to have really meaningful reforms with teeth, you need interstate action. That is, you need Nancy to prevent guns from moving from New Hampshire, for example, into Massachusetts, or for that matter, from Virginia up by 95 into Massachusetts. Any sense how we'll get there?
Unlikely, given national politics, given local politics, unlikely. I mean, New Hampshire is a completely different atmosphere with respect to gun control than Massachusetts is. I mean, it's also interesting, by the way, that Mr. Wallace actually approved of the bill, or was quoted as approving of the bill, in part because it requires police chiefs to state in writing their reasons for denying licenses. So his rationale for supporting the bill was that there would be some means of appealing from denials. So the police chief couldn't do it simply based on, just a yes or no kind of situation. I don't think that that's going to mean a whole lot. I would imagine the police chief's determination would be it. But the point about a regional problem continues to beg for a regional or a national solution.
All right. Well, let's move on to our hubbubs. These are the stories that fell below the fold but caught the attention of our panelists. Let me start with you, Dante Ramos, your hubbub for this week.
Well, as everyone listening to this probably knows, parking is scarce in Boston, and people take the issue seriously enough that come winter, whether to remove lawn chairs from shoveled-out parking spaces is a major public policy question. Starting next week, there is a new app called Haystack that's launching in Boston. It allows drivers who need curbside parking spaces to pay drivers who are about to pull out curbside parking spaces. And there's a lot of people who think that this is really terrible, and it's unclear whether the city will even tolerate it. From my point of view, on the upside, it could start at least a broader conversation about the parking problem in Boston and parking policies, from space savers to minimum parking requirements in new development to whether parking meters should be priced at higher rates. On the downside, it gives the city has some pretty famously assertive drivers, and it gives them one more thing to disagree about and fight over.
Just what we need. Just what we need. Nancy, what about you? What about your hubbub?
There was a report that was actually on the ACLU web page about an 86-year-old photographer who goes around the country taking pictures of iconic landmarks. He was taking pictures of the iconic Dorchester gas tank with a wonderful painting on it. Which many, many people have done. As he's standing there taking the pictures, the security guard asks for his name and address and then takes his license plate number, and then he is visited by the FBI. Someone filed a suspicious activity report against this 86-year-old photographer, raising the question of whether or not these suspicious activity reports have simply gone too far. Whether we're simply putting, it's the old concept of garbage in, garbage out. You create a database in which there is garbage, and then you wonder why people can't make head or tail of it.
Oh, boy. Well, here's my hubbub. It's about some news about the Red Sox, not on the field news, which has been bad enough. But this is about the $7 million deal that gave the team permanent rights to the city streets surrounding Fenway Park. The Sox basically bought from the city the rights to shut down Yawkey Way and use it as an extension to Fenway Park to sell food and concessions during games. Also bought air rights over Lansdowne Street. But Mayor Marty Walsh is criticizing the deal, saying it was rushed through the BRA, whose members had only a few hours to study the deal before approving it. It does seem like a sweet and cheap deal for a hugely wealthy sports team. And now the mayor's office calls it a bad deal for taxpayers, one of the first times that his administration has criticized something that the previous administration of Tom Menino did. And response from the BRA? Well, according to the Boston Globe, a BRA spokesman told the Globe that only the former director, Peter Mead, and his deputy could explain this deal. We could also add former mayor Tom Menino. So accountability is important, but that belongs to the previous administration. So there we go.
If it makes them win, I'll be happy.
Okay. If anything to make them win, not a lot of that happening. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, professor at Harvard Law School, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, same to you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Father, Sons, Baseball, and the Field of Dreams. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.